this will seem kind of familiar. It'll follow a format. If you were here last week when Mike Gray spoke, we're also going to be in 2 Timothy this week, starting in 2 Timothy. So if you want to turn to 2 Timothy chapter 2, that'll be a helpful starting point for you. Mike Gray was in 2 Timothy 3 last week. I'm in 2 Timothy 2 this week, and this isn't random. Pastor Brad is planning on starting a series in 2 Timothy soon, and as we were talking about these speaking dates coming up, I'm kind of asking, what do you think would be good? What would be helpful? He suggested the idea, what if we explored some of the Old Testament references that show up in the New Testament epistle of Timothy? And so last week we had the opportunity to do that, and this week we will also be doing that. So 2 Timothy will be where we'll start. It will not be where we will spend the majority of our time, and it will be where we will end. So the idea being that I'm not going to try to preach this as Brad would preach it, which is good because Brad is going to preach it. And that would be not ideal for me, for to you all here have Brad preach the exact same passage that I just preached. But the idea being that hopefully this morning we'll be able to provide a little bit of context and spend a little bit more time diving into that context that maybe wouldn't that wouldn't fit very neatly into a service time otherwise. So 2 Timothy chapter 2 is where we're going to start this morning. This idea actually of those Old Testament references within the New Testament has been something that's been really intriguing to me lately. There's a scholar who refers to these as hyperlinks. And that has been helpful terminology to me, and I can only assume has not been terminology that has been widely used throughout church history in reference to this. It's sort of a modern thing. Now, when I think of hyperlinks, so me and my brother years ago, I think we invented this game. I could be wrong. The way I remember it, we invented it. We very creatively called it the Wikipedia game. And what you do is you go to Wikipedia, and you are given a page to start on, like Brussels sprouts. And you have to find a way to get to some other random, totally not connected to anything other page, like American Ninja Warrior. And the only way you can get there is by clicking on the blue hyperlinks that exist on that first page, getting you hopefully a little bit closer and a little bit closer and a little bit closer till you eventually have weaved your way through all of Wikipedia to land at the whatever. We were homeschooled. It was... But you're familiar with the concept of the hyperlink. We see them in our news stories. We see them all over the internet. It's a little highlighted blue. You may need it. You may not. Sometimes you can read it and they're like, oh, I understand the context without this. But if you need greater context, you can click on that. It will take you to a different article, and it explains more fully what is being discussed. The New Testament is full of hyperlinks. And these would have been hyperlinks that, for the vast majority of a first century predominantly Jewish, or at least very familiar with Jewish history, they wouldn't have not have needed to click on that link. They would have understood the reference. We are a little bit removed from that today. So this morning, I want to click on a hyperlink in 2 Timothy chapter 2, which will actually send us to spend most of our time in Numbers, which preaching out of Numbers was not something that was on my bucket list. But it's been really good. So this will be relatively simple this morning, which is good. I'm better with simple. But we will be just very plainly trying to look at the text that Paul references and see how it would apply and why he's using it here with Timothy. So 2 Timothy chapter 2, let's start in verse 14. And we'll read down to verse 19, which is really where we're going to find our hyperlink, as it were. Paul is writing to Timothy, who is a pastor of a church. So he's writing specifically to an individual here. If you read the book leading up to it, it's very clear that he is trying to encourage Timothy in the face of false teaching. There have been false teachings and dissensions and all sorts of non-gospel things that are going on. And Paul is seeking to encourage and challenge Timothy in this. So really, the whole chapter and a half leading up to this point have been encouraging him in this. And this is just a continuation of that. So Paul says to Timothy, remind them, starting in verse 14, remind them, that would be the people, remind them of these things and charge them before God not to fight about words. This is useless and leads to the ruin of those who listen. He's saying, don't get caught up in all of like the tertiary side arguments. Focus on the main thing. Be diligent, you, Timothy, to present yourself to God as one approved, a worker who does not need to be ashamed, correctly teaching the word of truth. Stick to God's truth, Timothy. Stick to the truth of Christ. Avoid irreverent and empty speech, since those who engage in it will produce even more godlessness, and their teaching will spread like gangrene throughout the congregation of Christ. Hymenaeus and Philetus are among those who have done this. They have departed from the truth, saying that the resurrection has already taken place and are ruining the faith of some. Now, when he says here that these two, Hymenaeus and Philetus, which how do you like either one of those names? He's already referenced them earlier in the book. These are false teachers who are coming from within the household of faith. But they are saying that the resurrection of Christ took place. Yes, but the resurrection that we look forward to, that's not actually happening. All the resurrections that have happened have happened. And that is understandably discouraging to people. And Paul is saying, don't get caught up in things like this. They're preaching falsehoods, and it is so discouraging, and it's ripping people down. It's spreading like gangrene. It's hurting those who believe. They have departed from the truth, and they're ruining the faith of some. But then we get to this. We get to verse 19. So we come right on the heels of kind of a discouraging, oh, we got some bad things going on. We have people who are being discouraged in their faith. But he says, Timothy, nevertheless, despite all of this, God's solid foundation stands firm, and it bears this inscription, the Lord knows those who are his. And let everyone who calls on the name of the Lord turn away from wickedness. Now, if you happen to own a Holman Christian Standard Bible or a Christian Standard Bible, which is the one that I tend to use, they actually do a really helpful thing where they put these hyperlinks in bold text, which is really helpful for someone like me. So even as you're just reading through the New Testament, you go, oh, that's talking about something, and gives the opportunity for me to pause and go look at that. So the bold part here, this is the part that sends us soaring back to Numbers, but the phrase, the Lord knows those who are his, and let everyone who calls on the name of the Lord turn away from wickedness. Now, we can understand that enough as a statement there. But Paul is saying something to put an idea in Timothy's head that's going to create a much greater context for all of that. So let's try to look at that greater context. Go ahead and turn to Numbers 16. Numbers 16. Now, I'm thankful for the Lord putting it on Mike's heart to look at Psalm 105 and 106 this morning, because I was actually thinking, I wish there's so much context leading up to this point in the story, and I would love to dive into all of the context, but you would not love for me to dive into all of the context. So we're going to try to get a little bit caught up to speed of where we are coming into Numbers 16. Israel has been freed from slavery in Egypt. God has miraculously brought them forth. These are the people that God promised he would give to Abraham. The group of people that God was going to use to bless the world was going to come through this group of people. He brought them out of Egypt. He brought them across the Red Sea, and they have just spent a year at Mount Sinai in the very presence of God, where God very specifically and intimately has chosen them as his people. And the people have agreed, yes, you are our God. And there's the rules and the laws and the regulations of the covenant that have all been laid out. And God has said, I'm going to bring you to Canaan. I'm going to bring you to the promised land. And in Numbers chapter 13, you read about the spies that were sent in to go scout out the land. And two of the spies come back saying the land is great. It's so rich. There's a lot of people there, but we know that God has given us this land. And 10 come back terrified because the cities are fortified. The people seem strong. We don't know if we can take this land. And they actually work up the people into fear. And you actually have Joshua come out and go, no, it's good. But the people are panicking. And there's just they sow dissent among the people of God. They're saying God is not going to give us this land that he has promised he will give us. And so the people say, fine, we will elect different leaders and we will go back to Egypt. This, understandably, upsets Israel's God. And he's at a point where he basically says to Moses, step out of the way. I'm just going to wipe these people out and I'll start over with you. And Moses begs and pleads on behalf of God's reputation. He says, no, the people of the nations know that you're the one who led these people out of Egypt. And if they die here, then they'll say that's your fault. Preserve them. So God, in his mercy and in his judgment and in his justice, does not completely destroy Israel, though they deserved it. But what he does do is he says, this generation, all of you who have complained, you don't get to see this promised land. You're going to be kept outside of it. In fact, you're going to wander around in the wilderness for 40 years until every last one of you who's over 20 years old dies off. The people of Israel will go into the promised land, but you who have stood against me will not. Then in an incredibly perplexing moment, at that moment, Israel gets all weepy-eyed. And they're like, well, we'll just go take the land now. Back when God was promising to be on their side, they were too hesitant to go. And now that God has said, you cannot go in, you'll wander in the desert, they try to go in and take it, and it goes about how you would expect it to go. That's where we are at the end of chapter 14. Then chapter 15, God gives a kind reminder in the form of rules and regulations. Again, he actually lays out what certain offerings and sacrifices are going to look like for them in the promised land. He's reminding them, you're going to make it. I'm going to make sure that you make it. And this is what it's going to look like. So as we roll into Numbers 16, that's everything that's been leading up to this. So Israel is... it's fresh off of being chosen specifically as the people of God. God has chosen them. They have agreed to follow God and his commands, but then they don't go into the land. God has kept them out. They rebelled again. They're upset. They don't know what's going on. This is all so fresh. And then we're here in Numbers 16. Why, as we read through this, think, why would Paul be referencing this? Numbers chapter 16, I'll read the first few verses here. And the goal here is not, we'll kind of just read through and discuss it as we read. Get a greater context for the story. And then we'll wrap up with some short application back in 2 Timothy. Numbers 16, now Korah, the son of, I felt bad for Jeff that he had to read this for the Bible, and now it's me. So this is a lot easier to read in your head at home. Now Korah, son of Izhar, son of Kohath, son of Levi, with Dathan and Abiram, sons of Eliab, and On, son of Peleth, nailed that one, sons of Reuben, took 250 prominent Israelite men who were leaders of the community and representatives in the assembly, and they rebelled against Moses. They came together against Moses and Aaron and told them, you have gone too far. Everyone in this entire community is holy. And the Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the Lord's assembly? They come to Moses unhappy with his leadership. They come to Aaron unhappy with apparently his priestly position within the household of Israel. Now this is interesting. Now Korah, it says specifically, is a Levite. And even though it mentions others and mentions that there's even one from the tribe of Reuben in here, throughout this narrative, Moses refers to this group as Levites. To them as the Levites. So this seems to be a quote-unquote Levite problem being presented here. They're unhappy with the leadership of Moses as a whole, but then they do seem to be frustrated and upset with the specific designation of Aaron and his line as the priests for the tabernacle. Now it's interesting because the Levites have already been given a special position within the house of Israel. As the camp is set up, the tabernacle, the tent of meeting, is there in the middle. And then the Levites are those who surround that. They're literally the ones who get to camp closest to the place of the dwelling of God. The Levites would have been tasked with serving the community, with serving the people, and with actually serving in the tabernacle itself. A lot of the upkeep. It's a very close and special place, but they are not satisfied with that. They are not pleased with that. They, it seems, see that Aaron and his line are able to actually go into the tent and commune and talk with God. And they come saying, you guys have it all wrong. You think you are so designated. You think you are so set apart. Look at, we are all holy. Now, maybe they mean all is like we are God's chosen people, the Israelites. So maybe they say we, the Levites, are holy, like we're even holier than the rest of everyone else. They basically say we should have the access to God that you have. The problem with this is they're wanting to approach God on their own terms, forgetting that God is being infinitely gracious to allow anyone to approach at all. Because this very human race is the one that severed the tie between creator and created in the first place. Rather than God scrapping humanity, he has graciously and kindly, through the line of Abraham, begun to dwell again with humanity. But when an infinite, holy, altogether other God condescends to dwell with created beings who are shaking their fist at that God, those beings need to come to him on his terms, not theirs. And it seems as if Korah and those with him have forgotten this. They come in saying, we are all holy. We deserve this special access. Step aside. Pick it up in verse 4. When Moses heard this, he fell face down. He fell on the ground. He recognized that this was not ultimately a rebellion against him or Aaron, but that it was a rebellion against God. And then he said to Korah and all of his followers, and this is where, if you clicked the hyperlink in 2 Timothy 2:19, it would take you to this verse, which would then expand to the full article. This is the verse it's referencing. He said to Korah and all of his followers, tomorrow morning the Lord will reveal who belongs to him, who is set apart, and the one that he will let come near him. He will let the one who chooses come near him. Korah, you and all your followers are to do this. And this is, I think, the indication that they were talking more specifically about special access within the tabernacle, because he assigned them that he basically creates a challenge that would have them doing work of their Aaronic priestly line. He says, tomorrow, take fire pans, and tomorrow place fire in them and put incense in them before the Lord. They are setting up the incense to approach God. And then he says, go ahead and set all this up. We'll do this tomorrow. And then the man the Lord chooses will be the one that is set apart. And then he says, it's actually you Levites who have gone too far. The Levite, Korah, and this group show up frustrated and angry at Moses. And Moses turns at them and says, I don't think you know what you're getting into. It's you who have gone too far. And then verse 8, it says, Moses also told Korah, now listen, Levites. Isn't it enough that for you that the God of Israel has separated you, the Levites, from the Israelite community to bring you near to himself? You've already been brought near, not even just as a chosen one of Israel, but even within that you've received a special designation to bring you near himself, to perform the work at the Lord's tabernacle and to stand before the community to minister to them. He has brought you near. And all your fellow Levites who are with you, but you are pursuing the priesthood as well. Therefore, it is you and all of your followers who have conspired against the Lord. As for Aaron, who is he that you should complain about him? Verse 12. Things shift just a little bit. We read that Moses sends for Dathan and Abiram, who are mentioned in that opening verse. Now, maybe he's reaching out to these men specifically, hoping to speak some sense into them. We're not told specifically, but it says Moses sends for Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab. But they said, we will not come. Is it not enough that you have brought us up from a land flowing with milk and honey to kill us in the wilderness? To take the words of God and to twist them for your own argument. God did, in fact, speak of a land flowing with milk and honey, but it is not the land where they had been. It is the land where they were going. And these men, in their bristling and standing up against Moses and his leadership, say, isn't it enough that you actually pulled us already from a land that was flowing with milk and honey? You've led us here to die in the wilderness. I understand, like, I have a bad memory sometimes. It's hard to remember things. But the reason they're in the wilderness is because they chose to not go take the land. And yet, that's somehow God's fault. That's Moses' fault now. And they're remembering their past so much better than it was. The land of their slavery is now mentally their land of milk and honey. You know, twisting God's words is something that goes all the way back to the opening pages of Scripture. You see the serpent twist the words of God in the garden. You see Eve not accurately represent what God has said. And that has been a problem for us ever since. Even if we listen with our own filter and we tweak it to fit our own needs. So Dathan and Abiram said this, "Is it not enough that you brought us up from the land flowing with milk and honey to kill us in the wilderness? Do you also have to appoint yourself as ruler over us?" Verse 14, "Furthermore, you didn't bring us to a land flowing with milk and honey, or give us an inheritance of fields and vineyards. All these things that God has promised you have not delivered, Moses. Will you gouge out the eyes of these men? We will not come." Moses is understandably frustrated with this. I read in verse 15, "Moses became angry and said to the Lord, 'Do not respect their offering.'" Remember, there's a challenge happening the next day, a challenge of offering before God. "Don't respect their offering. I have not taken one donkey from them or mistreated a single one of them." And then in verse 16, we read, "Moses told Korah," and this is reiterating what he'd told them earlier, "You and all of your followers are to appear before the Lord tomorrow, you, they, and Aaron." So you have Aaron, the appointed priestly representative for Israel, and then those who believe that they deserve to be in that position. "Each of you is to take his fire pan, place incense in it, present his fire pan before the Lord. 250 fire pans, you and Aaron are each to present your fire pan also." So then we fast forward to the next day. It's the morning of the challenge. Verse 18 says that each man took his fire pan, placed fire in it, put incense in it, and stood at the entrance to the tent of meeting along with Moses and Aaron. Now, we need to get this in our heads. Like, this is a mental image that I had to stop and make sure that I focused on. We get so, we are so ridiculously blessed and spoiled today to be able to access God anywhere. Because of the priestly work of Christ, to have that access. Where when we think of standing in the presence of God, we think, "Oh, I am. Like, look, I'm wherever I am, I'm standing in the presence of God." But God has chosen for this point in time to dwell in a specific way. His feet are literally touching down on earth in this tent of dwelling, in this tabernacle, and you have 250 men who are literally standing at the entrance as if they're demanding an audience with God. It was not just a casual, like, "Oh, I'm here." It was going to be marching into a special and designated area. We read in verse 19 that after Korah had assembled the whole community against them, so these leaders have gotten the people behind them, assembled the whole community against them at the entrance, the tent of meeting. Whatever happens, it's not going to go unnoticed. Everyone's on watch. And after they had assembled them, the glory of the Lord appeared to the whole community. Now, if you'll remember the way the glory of the Lord showed itself, the way God made himself visible to his people was through fire, through a fiery cloud. That's what's happening over this temple, where there is a small army of 250 men ready to march in. The Lord makes himself seen to the whole community. And in verse 20, we read, "The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron and says, 'Separate yourself from this community, so I may consume them instantly.'" God promised that this generation would die in the wilderness. He is ready to fast forward that. Still happening, but he's saying, okay, maybe now. Maybe now instead of later. Maybe immediately instead of gradually. But in verse 22, we read about the intercession of Moses and Aaron. But Moses and Aaron fell face down and said, God, God who gives breath to all, when one man sins, will you vent your wrath on the whole community? They plead for mercy on the people, saying, it is really these men who have stirred up the people. These are the true dissenters. These are the ones who are speaking falsehoods and speaking against you, Lord. These others are just, they maybe don't know what they're on board for. Lord, please do not wipe out this entire congregation because of the sins of a few men. You know, it's interesting. If this sermon this morning was just going to be on number 16, there would be all this, there's all this beautiful imagery of intercession. There's so many different themes. But we're not necessarily here to understand all of that. So we're just kind of cruising through this to understand the context of why is Paul referencing? Remember, this is a story that Paul's trying to encourage Timothy to keep the faith and stand firm. And this is what he's referencing. This is that hyperlink. That one little sentence is talking about all of this. So Moses and Aaron intercede, and they say, God, please do not punish the entire community for the sins of a few. And then in verse 23, we read, the Lord replied to Moses, and he gives him a very simple command. Tell the community, tell the people, get away from the dwellings of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. Moses and Aaron are pleading, the people deserve to be spared. Lord, show mercy, show kindness, show grace. And the Lord says, I will show mercy on those who turn away from these wicked ones. I will show mercy to those who obey. God is saying pretty plainly, you're with me or you're with them. Choose. So Moses got up. This is verse 25. Moses got up and went to Dathan and Abiram, and the elders of Israel followed him. And he warned the community. He said, get away from the tents of these wicked men. Don't touch anything that belongs to them, or you will be swept away because of all of their sins. So they got away from the dwellings of Korah and Dathan and Abiram. They listen. They turn away from these men. They turn away from their false teachings. And by implication, they are turning back to God incredibly imperfectly. But they are. But even as this is happening, even as the community is turning away, we read that meanwhile, Dathan and Abiram came out and stood at the entrance of their tents with their wives, their children, and their infants. It's almost as if, well, the community as a whole is turning from this falsehood and turning from this iniquity. They are standing firmly in it. They walk out at the entrance. I can almost see it, arms crossed. Do your worst. Well, in verse 28, we read, and again, remember, we still have Korah and his 250 dissenters who are standing at the entrance of the tabernacle, ready to go in and demand an audience. We have Dathan and Abiram who are standing at the entrance of their tents defiantly. And Moses says, this is how you will know that the Lord has sent me to do all these things. This is how you'll know that I did not just appoint myself to this. This is how you'll know that God is in all of this. And it was not just of my own will. If these men die naturally, as all people would, and suffer the fate of all, then the Lord has not sent me. Essentially, he's saying, if nothing happens, you have every right to stand here. Then everything you've been, like I have put myself in this position, apparently God does not keep his promises. If nothing happens, then all of your arguments are valid. But if the Lord brings about something unprecedented, and the ground opens its mouth and swallows them, along with all of their belongings, so that they may go down alive into Sheol, into the grave, then you will know that these men have despised the Lord. That is not subtle. And I feel as if it would have been plainly understood even if Moses didn't explain what this all meant. But just in case there were any hard-headed Israelites left. Moses kind of lays the groundwork for what might be about to happen and what it means. And then verse 31 says, just as he finished speaking. Now think of this. I know, at least for me, maybe you're better at this than me. It's so easy for me to read biblical narrative and like recognize it's true without thinking about it as reality. This happened. You're part of the community of Israel. You're standing and you're watching this rebellion take place. And Moses says, hey, if nothing happens to these men, then it's all been a sham. But if the ground opens up and swallows them, then God is real, which means you better obey him. And as he finishes speaking, verse 31, the ground beneath them split open. The earth opened its mouth and it swallowed them and their households, all Korah's people and all their possessions. They went down alive into Sheol with all that belonged to them. The earth closed over them, and they vanished from the assembly. At their cries, all the people of Israel who were around them fled because they thought, the earth may swallow us too. And as if that wasn't enough, fire also came from the Lord and consumed the 250 men who were presenting incense in the tabernacle. This is what Paul's referencing to Timothy. There's more to the chapter. It's fascinating. But read it on your own. We won't finish the chapter here this morning just because of the nature of what we're trying to accomplish. Now, before we jump back to 2 Timothy, and so I will say this, as I studied this, as I read Numbers, I was like, wow, there's so much in this. This is really good. This is really fascinating. And I eventually got to a point where I hit a roadblock and thought, oh, but like, what does this have to do with the 2 Timothy thing? It's obviously here for a reason. It's not just like a random connection, like there was a nice, cool little catchphrase from that moment in history, so let's use that catchphrase. This is here for a reason. And as we, just before we dive back into that, I just want to take a couple minutes here and kind of point out something to you that I've realized through, not through my own study and understanding, but like the biblical authors were not just like casually and mindlessly writing things down. They were literary geniuses. Let me show you a little bit of what I mean here. Now, this is all happening. This is narrative. This is a history account. But look at the way that even words are used here. So back in Numbers 13, when you have the 10 spies who come back giving a poor account. Numbers 13:32 reads this way. They were afraid of the men of the land, so they gave a negative report to the Israelites about the land that they had scouted. This is what they said. The land we have passed through to explore is one that devours its inhabitants. And all the people we saw in it are men of great size. Joshua has a rebuttal to this. And he says, no. Actually, if we're going to take the land, it is the Lord that will swallow the people of this land. The ground will open up and swallow them. God will devour them. The land will devour them, and it will be ours. And yet here, in number 16, we see a people who did not go into the promised land for fear of being devoured by it. We see Joshua who recognized that it is God who does the devouring. The people, in their effort to remain safe, have locked themselves into the wilderness for 40 years, and the ground opened up and devoured them anyway, because they were fearing the wrong thing. Like, that's a literary connection that's supposed to click. Like, oh, I was fearful of being devoured. You should be fearful of being devoured. But make sure you are fearing the one who owns it all. Make sure there's the proper fear and respect for him. So now the super simple transition back to 2 Timothy chapter 2. And these will be closing statements of application that I hope will be helpful in all of this. And again, Brad is, I believe, going to be preaching through this passage in a few weeks. He will spend more time here in 2 Timothy than we have this morning. But hopefully this will help you give some of the context of this Numbers passage to recognize even more fully what's being said. So again, just a reminder that Paul is saying to Timothy, in the midst of all of this false teaching, in the midst of all of this oppression, this is his encouragement. Nevertheless, God's solid foundation stands firm. That solid foundation, God's solid foundation is the church that he has promised will not fail. And the church is comprised of his own people. God is saying, Paul is saying here that God's solid foundation, his own people stand firm. They are sealed with this inscription, the Lord knows those who are his. Remember, Timothy, how there was a moment in the past when there were those who were even within the household of faith. Last week, if you were here, we learned about Jannes and Jambres, who were those who stood outside of the household of Israel and condemned it. But here we see those who are claiming, who are even of Moses or of Abraham's lineage, they are here within the household, within the community, and they are standing opposed to the truth. Paul's saying, Timothy, do you remember that? Do you remember how uncomfortable that was? Do you remember how difficult that was? Do you remember how painful that was? But Timothy, remember that the Lord knows those who are his. The pain and frustration of the unknown that you may feel is not a pain and frustration that God feels about the unknown. Now, this seal, this inscription really has a negative and a positive element to it. In the negative, the Lord knowing those who are his means that the Lord also knows those who are not. You cannot fool the infinite, holy, almighty, altogether other God. He is fully aware of those who stand in opposition to him. But we also know that he is far more patient than we deserve, giving the people an opportunity to repent. Because the positive side of this equation and his encouragement to Timothy is saying, Timothy, be encouraged. I know everyone in your church. I know everyone in your body. Yeah. I'm not a pastor, but I can only imagine what it would be like to desperately want to get to know your people, but no, you really can't know all of them deeply. And there's just so many what ifs, even in a room this size. There are not what ifs with God. The things that seem like they are shaking the church to its core, whether it be a local congregation or the church within our country, or even the universal church as a whole, the things that feel so unsettling are not actually unsettling anything. God knows those who are his, and he will preserve his foundation, the church. So if you are here this morning, and you are of God, take heart. You haven't slipped through the cracks. This is not all happening apart from you. He has promised to preserve you, to preserve his people. But the second inscription, the second seal on this foundation is, let everyone who calls on the name of the Lord turn away from wickedness. It's not just sit here and feel happy that you are God's. I read this week that, I thought this was helpful, but those who take comfort in the first inscription must take responsibility for the second. The Lord knows those who are his, so take heart, but also take action. Because one of the most obvious ways that God knows those who are his is because his own turn from iniquity when they are shown their wrongdoing. This isn't perfection. The crushing weight of having to be perfect has been removed from off of our shoulders, and we now bear Christ's perfect life. It's not about perfection, but it is about continual Godward steps and growth. And then just one last quick challenge is just a challenge to read the whole Bible. I say this as someone who for years basically never even ventured into the Old Testament for my lack of understanding and for fear of all the confusing things. But the New Testament authors, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, expects you to have an understanding of the Old Testament because it actually helps paint the picture of what's happening in the New. It's super easy to read a letter to a church and be like, ah, the command to do this, the command to do this, the command to do this. It's simple to read the Gospels and be like, oh, Jesus seems like a great guy. Look at all the things he's doing. But everything we read about in there is really fulfilling the entire narrative that we're seeing taking place within the Old. God has given us the Scriptures as revelation of himself. He wants to be known. And we might look at some of the older passages in Scripture and think, well, we're not Israel. What am I supposed to do with this? We may not be Israel, but God is still God. And there's much to be learned about him there. So this is just a challenge. Explore the hyperlinks in your Bible. Learn the source material that's actually within the very source material that you're already reading. And as you seek God, know that those who seek God, the only ones who really seek God are those that God has given that desire to. God knows those who are his. If you're his this morning, then turn from iniquity.